Last time, 2 weeks ago, we went through the whole concept of Bechor, of firstborn. We talked about how that related to the Karban Pesach, to the Paschal sacrifice, which are sheep or goats. We talked about how the struggle of who would be the Bechor was a struggle. We know of it as a struggle between Yaakov and Esau, but it really goes back to between the Jews and the Mitzrim and the Egyptians. We talked about how that ties in to the death of the firstborn and the month of Nisan. Now, after the class was over, several of you asked that why would the Egyptians have wanted the birthright? Why would they want to serve Hashem? After all, we talked about how Bechor, it means the one who is serving Hashem in the best possible way, the one who is leading the service of Hashem. And that was a well-taken point, and obviously I failed to make it clear that there are two aspects to Bechor. There is the firstborn, the birthright, in regard to spirituality, and that, of course, the Egyptians had no interest in, but then there is the Bechor, the birthright, regarding the physical world, materialism. And that, of course, is what the Egyptians wanted. Just as with Esav, what he really wanted was the blessings of this world. That's what he wanted to be the firstborn for, to get the blessings. Now that's what the Egyptians wanted as well. But in a totality, the Bechorah, the firstborn, is to be the center of history, to be the ones that are the main players in a historical sense. And that, of course, is our position. And that's what the Egyptians felt was their position and was not ours. And that was the struggle. And Hashem was telling Paro that if you're not going to accept this, then I'm going to kill your firstborn, to make it clear that the Jews are really the Bechor, B'ni Bechori Yisrael. That's what we spoke about last time. I mentioned last time that the next step, the next point to understand, and this will fill in the complete picture for us, is what in fact was the Egyptians' real role to play. Everybody has a role to play, and their role was not as Bechor, so what role did they have? You'll say, what difference does it make? But it makes a very big difference. As we will see, as we go through this evening's discussion, we will see that the role that they were meant to play, but were not willing to play, is one that we ourselves often struggle with, and therefore is very significant for us. Now, as I mentioned last time, I had given a class to women before Pesach last year, and I was not sure, I didn't remember what I had said or what I didn't say, and it seemed that there weren't too many people who remembered what I said last year anyway, so it didn't matter. But this week, Mrs. Kaiser said to me that this is the class that I had given last year, and she remembers it, and she didn't mind hearing it again. But since nobody else seems to remember it, I don't think it's a problem to repeat it. But I don't even know if I'm going to say the exact same things as last year, or if it'll be somewhat different. But if some of this is familiar to you, then perhaps you were there last year. Now, the title of the class is Yosef, what is it? Yosef, Egypt, and the Golden Calf. It doesn't seem at first to be directly Pesach-related. I mean, obviously, Egypt is Pesach-related. Yosef was the viceroy in Egypt, but we will see how it really is very much Pesach-related as well. Let us begin by understanding, let's understand what happened with the golden calf. Let's start off with the Egel Hazav, the golden calf, and talk about what happened over there. We know that when the Jews left Egypt, and that's what we're celebrating on Pesach, we left and we then began our spiritual growth, our spiritual ascent, and we went up in levels for 49 days. And we count, that's Sfiras HaOmer. We counted 49 days. And on the 50th day was the 6th day of Sivan, which of course was Matan Torah, the day that we received the Torah. When we had reached that pinnacle of spirituality and we saw the greatest revelation of Hashem the world had ever seen and has ever seen. The only time we're waiting for the time when Hashem's revelation will be even greater when Mashiach comes. But at this point, that is the greatest it's ever been. Now, after that happened, that was with the Ten Commandments, that was the Aseres HaDibros, and after that, Moshe went up the mountain by himself. At that point, he was on the mountain, but we were all there, and we all saw what happened. But then, we said we couldn't take the presence of Hashem directly anymore. It was too much for us. And therefore, Moshe went by himself up the mountain for the next 40 days in order to receive the entirety of the Torah, the written law, the oral law, everything from Hashem. And he was to return 40 days later. Now, 40 days later comes out to be Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz. And that is when Moshe Rabbeinu was supposed to come down from the mountain with the tablets and present it to the Jews. Now that would have been a day of great celebration, because that would have been the day that we received the tablets, the Aseret HaDibros. And that was an incredible time. Only, as you know, we miscounted. And on the 16th of Tammuz, the Jews expected Moshe to come down. And he didn't. And so that led to a breakdown amongst the Jewish people, which was led by the Erev Rav. Now the Erev Rav were those Egyptians that latched on to the Jewish people when we left Egypt. And they decided they would like to be with us. They were impressed by everything that happened to us. And rather than stand against us, they decided to join us as we left. And Moshe Rabbeinu here, we of course would never be able to criticize Moshe, but the Torah criticizes Moshe and says that he made a mistake, that he accepted these Egyptians as converts. Now, you can't really call them converts yet, because there's no such thing as conversion until we get the Torah. As I've mentioned many times in other classes, until we get the Torah, we are a family. We're the children of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. A family can't accept converts. You can't make yourself into somebody else's family. A nation can accept converts. And when we got the Torah, that's when we became a nation. And at that point, we were able to accept converts. Be that as it may, Moshe Rabbeinu accepted these Erev Rav, these Egyptians, to join with us as we went to Har Sinai. And he did not ask Hashem whether it was a good idea. He figured it must be a good idea for them to join up with us. But it was really a bad idea. That was not the time to try to bring in those from the outside. And they ended up hurting us when the episode with the golden calf happened. Because as the breakdown happened on the 16th of Tammuz, and people started to doubt, where is Moshe? And they were afraid that Moshe was gone forever, and there was a lack of leadership and a concern. And so they came to Aaron, and they said, we need a God to lead us. So this is not the forum to go through exactly what they were thinking. Was it real idolatry? Was it not real idolatry? Whatever it was, we know it was a big sin. And they asked for a God. Now Aaron was in a quandary. Aaron needed to stop them, but Aaron knew that he couldn't just say stop, because his nephew Hur, who tried to stop them, had been murdered by this mob. So Aaron knew it was pointless to try to stop them, because then he'd be murdered as well, and then where would they be? So he knew that their only hope was for him to delay them as best as he could. And so he asked them to bring gold. And as you all know, they all went to the women to get their gold. The women refused. And so the men took their own gold and gave it to Aaron. And they said, make for us a god with this gold. So Aaron took the gold and threw it in the fire. That's what the verse tells us. The pasuk says he threw it in the fire, and out came a golden calf. And that's how the breakdown happened on the first and the 16th of Tammuz. And the next morning is when they actually worshipped the golden calf before Moshe came down from the mountain. And so a day which was meant to be a day of great celebration, the 17th of Tammuz, turned into a terrible calamity. And today is the day that we fast and we begin our observance of the 3 weeks. It's a very sad day on our calendar. How did the gold become a golden calf? He threw it in the fire, and that's what the pasuk says. Va'ashlicheu va'esh, I threw it in the fire, va'yetzei ha'egal hazeh, and out came this calf. That's what Aaron tells Moshe. So what happened over there? How did it happen? So Rashi tells us two explanations for how it happened. The first explanation, Rashi says, is that the Erev Rav were there, these Egyptians. And the Egyptians were very into kishuf, into black magic. We know that black magic today does not exist in reality, meaning it can't be used. People don't know how to use it. They may use sleight of hand and trick others into thinking that they're performing black magic, but we know it's not really in use today. But we do know that the concept exists. There is such a thing as black magic, and the Egyptians knew how to use it very well. And so things worked in Egypt with kishuf. with black magic. That's why when Moshe Rabbeinu first came to Paro, and Aaron throws down his stick and it turns into a snake, Paro says, big deal. And he has his people throw down their sticks and they turn into snakes. Because that's what went on in Egypt. It wasn't a big deal. These sorts of minor miracles like that went on all the time. And so the Erevav were there, and they knew Kishuf. And when Aaron threw the gold in the fire, they used their black magic, and out came a golden calf. That's the first explanation Rashi says. Now, why would it be a golden calf? Why not a golden head of cabbage? Why a golden calf, of all things? From which vision? That's interesting. But that's really the other way around. We said that with Yechezkel, the reason why the ox turned into a cherub was because not to remind Hashem of the golden calf. But that follows this story. Because what? That's the second explanation of Rashi. We'll get to that one. Okay, because they worshipped the calf. You see, these are Egyptians. And the Egyptians were used to a certain type of idolatry. What idolatry were they used to? They were used to worshipping a calf. Now, we know they also worshipped sheep and goats. And that's why on the 10th of Nisan, which is Shabbos HaGadol, the Shabbos before Pesach, when the Jews took the sheep or the goat for their Karban Pesach, for their sacrifice, and the Egyptians weren't able to stop us, that was something which is a tremendous miracle, because they were cringing at the fact that we were slaughtering their deity and they weren't able to stop us. That was an amazing miracle that Hashem did for us. So they worshipped sheep and goats as well. But they also worshipped the calf. They worshipped not only the ovine family, but also the bovine family. How do we know that? Well, first of all, there's a pasuk, there's a verse in Jeremiah, that says, Egla Yefefia Mitzrayim, that Egypt is a beautiful calf. It likens Egypt to a calf. The Malbim says over there that that's because they worshipped the calf. That was their idolatry. And you all know it from the song we sing when we light the Hanukkah menorah, and there we recount many things that happened to the Jewish people, including the Egyptian slavery and redemption. And we say, Beshibud Malchus Egla. We say we were under the sovereignty of the kingdom of Egla, of the calf. And that's what Egypt is known as. And so the calf is one of the things that they worship. And it seems to have been their primary worship, actually. And that's why when the Erev Rav were going to conjure up some form, some icon to worship, they conjure up a calf. The Jews also were familiar with the idolatry of Ego, of the calf, because they had been in Egypt for over 200 years, and they were familiar with it. They saw it all the time. And so that was the most likely frame of reference with idolatry would be a calf. And so that's what came up when they divined over this gold in the fire. That's what Rashi says. Now there is a second explanation in Rashi, and that was alluded to before. And the second explanation is in how this gold, which was in the fire, came out as a calf. So the second explanation is that Yosef, we know Yosef was the viceroy in Egypt. And he was a viceroy for 80 years. Yosef's influence over the Egyptians was incredible. We have no other leader, we have no other king in Jewish history, in recorded history, that ruled for that long a period of time. We have a king that ruled for 55 years. David HaMelech ruled for 40 years. 80 years is a really long time. That's several generations. And it's already, he's there, and everybody knows Yosef as the viceroy, and really the acting king, because he had power, although he wouldn't usurp Paro, but he had incredible power. Yosef, in the bracha that Yaakov gives Yosef on Yaakov's deathbed, and later on that Moshe Rabbeinu gives to Yosef's descendants, is that of a shor, is that of an ox. Yaakov says, Bonos tzada alei shor, which means that the daughters of Egypt would stand, shore means a wall, they would stand on the wall to look at Yosef, because Yosef was a very beautiful person, and the daughters of Egypt would stand on the wall to look at Yosef, to see what he looked like. But the word shore and shor are spelled exactly the same way, with a very slight difference in vowel. And we know that there is that he also is likened to an ox. Just as many of the Shvatim, many of the tribes are likened to different animals. Dan is a snake, Yehuda is an Aryeh, is a lion, and Yosef is a shor. And that's why later on Moshe Rabbeinu says, Bechor shoro hadar lo. That he's this ox with this grandeur that Yosef has. So, ox, the power of an ox, the strength of an ox, whatever it is, but that's what Yosef has. That's the bracha of Yosef. This phrase, Ale Shur, which is two words, Ayin Lamed Yud, Shin Vav Resh, which means on the wall. Also, if you change Shur to Shor, change the U to an O, and make it ox instead of wall, then I have to stop for one moment. I made one error. The word shur doesn't mean wall. It means to see. Ashurenu v'lo karov. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Ale shur. They went up in order to see Yosef. That's ale shur. At any rate, the word shur can also be read as shor, as an ox. And later on, when Yosef dies, the Egyptians do not want Yosef taken up to Israel, to Eretz Yisrael, to be buried, as Yaakov was. Yaakov made Yosef swear that he, Yaakov, would be taken up and buried in Israel. And that's what happened. Yosef also made his children swear that when they leave Egypt, they'll take his bones with them and bury him in Israel. But when he died, since the slavery was already close to starting, the Jews couldn't leave. They weren't able to take Yosef up. And the Egyptians took Yosef's body, put it in a coffin, and put the coffin in the Nile River. They sunk it into the Nile River. Now, in Parashas Beshalach, when the Jews are ready to leave Egypt on the 15th of Nisan, which is Pesach, they're ready to go, and Moshe Rabbeinu has a problem. Moshe has to fulfill this oath that the Jews had made, that they will take Yosef's bones with them when they leave. But Yosef is at the bottom of the Nile. Well, what are they supposed to do? So Moshe took a piece of parchment and wrote on the parchment God's name, the name that we don't know, and he wrote on the parchment Ale Shor, which can also mean rise up, ox, and he threw the parchment in the Nile, in the river. And when he did that, the ox, meaning Yosef, rose to the surface. And when that happened, he was able to take the Aron, he was able to take that ark with them as they went up to Israel, to Eretz Israel. There, at that episode, when he got the coffin out of the Nile, was Micha. And Micha was someone who later ended up being an idolatrous person who led us to a lot of trouble later on. And Micha got hold of this parchment. Apparently, when the coffin rose to the surface, the parchment was there too. And he got that parchment. And so now, when Aaron takes the gold and throws it in the fire, and now there's gold in the fire, along comes Micha, who is into idolatry, takes the parchment that has God's name on it, and says, rise up, O ox, Ale Shor, and throws it in the fire. And an ox rises from the fire, the golden calf. And that is the second explanation, Rashi says, of how this gold turned into a calf, rising from the fire. Now, it is not coincidental, and rather striking, that Yosef is the power of the ox. He's likened to a shor. And Egypt worships the calf. And Yosef is the viceroy of Egypt. That's not coincidental. Yosef's power is the power, whatever this means, of the bovine family, of the ox. That's the strength he has. The Egyptians are likened to a calf. a similar strength, a similar position. That's what the Egyptians are. So much so that this same parchment with the same words that causes Yosef's body to rise from the bottom of the Nile causes gold in a fire to turn into a calf, to turn into the idolatry of the Egyptians. The same words in the same parchment. We see then that Yosef and the Egyptians are two sides of the same coin, where they both represent the power of Shor, the power of the ox. Where last week we spoke about how the Egyptians were trying to usurp us in our position of Bechor, which is represented by Tzon, by the ovine family. But in reality, what are the Egyptians? They are Egel, the bovine family, which is also represented by Yosef. And if you want to say it more clearly, the same strength that Yosef uses in a positive way, the Egyptians adulterate it and use it in a negative way. But it's two sides of the same coin. Egel representing the Egyptians, Shor, the ox, the adult ox, representing Yosef. This also helps to understand a very puzzling Rashi in the name of Rav Moshe Hadarshan in the beginning of Parshas Chukas. See, in the beginning of Parshas Chukas, we have a passage that we just read. We just read it 2 weeks ago. Parshas Para. All about the Para Aduma, the red heifer. And the Para Aduma, we know, is a procedure that is done in order to purify people from the impurity of the dead. It's something which we don't have today, which we will have when Mashiach comes. Over there, there's a whole procedure outlined by the Torah of what to do. And you take this red heifer, you go, the Kohen takes the red heifer, takes the Parah Aduma, takes it to a mountain east of Yerushalayim. He slaughters it there, then takes the blood and sprinkles it towards the temple, towards the Beis HaMikdash. Then the entire body of this cow is burned, and the ashes are used, mixed with water, to sprinkle on people who are impure. Rashi, over there, going through all the details, corresponds this Parah Aduma with the Egel HaZahav. And Rashi says, the Parah Aduma, the red heifer, is a kapara, is an atonement for the Egel HaZahav, for the golden calf. In addition to being a purification process for us, it is also an atonement for the golden calf. How so? So Rashi shows that just as the Jews threw off the yoke of heaven with the golden calf, so too the Parah Aduma has to be a cow that never carried a yoke. Just as when Moshe came down from the mountain, he took the golden calf and pulverized it into dust and then sprinkled it on the Jewish people, so too the Parah Aduma, the red heifer, is burned to ashes and sprinkled on people. And Rashi goes through many different similarities between the Parah Aduma and the Egel HaZahav. In fact, Chazal tell us, our sages say, that it's a mashal, it's a parable, that just as if there would be a child in the palace of the king, and the child would dirty the palace, the mother of the child would come and clean up after the child. So Chazal tell us it's the same thing. The Egel is a child, a young calf, has sullied Klal Yisrael. We are dirtied because of him, because of this Egel. The mother, the Parah Aduma, which is a mother cow, comes and cleans up the mess. And that's the Parah Aduma, the red heifer, which now atones for the golden calf, for the Egel HaZahav. That's what Chazal tell us. The question is, and the difficulty is, that we know, as I just described before, that the Egel HaZahav took place when? When did the Jews sin with the Egel HaZahav? What date? Okay, the 17th of Tammuz. The 17th of Tammuz, which is 40 days after the receiving of the Torah. The problem is that the mitzvah of Parah Aduma was given to us beforehand. We got the mitzvah of Parah Aduma before even getting the Torah. Because there was one stop between leaving Egypt, between the splitting of the sea, and getting to Har Sinai, and getting to Mount Sinai. We stopped at a place called Marah. And there at Marah, we were given some mitzvos. We were given Kibud Avaim, honoring parents. We were given Shabbos. And we were also given Parah Aduma. We were given that mitzvah, Parah Aduma, at Marah. That precedes the sin of the golden calf by at least a month, if not more. More than a month. Almost two months. By 2 months. How can then the Parah Aduma be an atonement for a sin that hadn't happened yet? How can God give us an atonement if we hadn't sinned? It's one thing if we had already sinned and Hashem says, I want to give you a way of achieving atonement. Here's a mitzvah that will atone for your sin. But we didn't sin yet. How can God give us a mitzvah now, before we sin, which later becomes an atonement? How could that be? Now we know that God does give us the refuah kodem u'makah. He gives us the remedy before the affliction. But sin does require free will. And to give us an atonement before we sin is almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's almost like, here, I know you're going to sin, take this now. That's a little bit of a slap in the face. What's that? It's okay, it's truth. It's okay, that's true. But we can understand it a little bit differently, which is a little bit more deeply. And that is that the Jews had been in the place of the golden calf. They had been in Egypt for over 200 years. We were on the brink of worshiping this idolatry, meaning if we would fall, God forbid, and sin with idolatry, this would no doubt be what we would sin with, and that would be the golden calf. Because that's where we had been for 200 years. That was our frame of reference. Hashem knew that. But, as we've just mentioned, the golden calf has a negative side and a positive side. The negative side being the golden calf, of course. The positive side being Yosef and what he represents, and the shor, the ox. And so Hashem wasn't preparing us for failure. Hashem was trying to give us a positive way of channeling that leaning towards the calf, that affinity, if you will, towards this power of the bovine family. Hashem was giving us a mitzvah to deal with, where we could be involved in that way, the Parah Aduma, rather than the golden calf. And the hope was that this would serve to prevent the sin of the golden calf. In the end, of course, that didn't happen, and we did sin. But once we sinned, now the Parah Aduma, which had previously been something which was meant to prevent the sin, now becomes an atonement for the sin, because it's two sides of the same coin. The same strength, the same power, one being used negatively and one being used positively. The Parah Aduma being the positive manifestation of the negative Egel HaZahav. Yosef being the positive manifestation of the negative Egyptians. All this so far has been a beautiful mathematical equation. We haven't explained what this strength is. What is it? What is this thing that the Egyptians are misusing, that the Egel HaZahav is a misuse of, while Yosef is using it properly, and the Parah Aduma is using it properly? What is this strength? And that's why the title is Yosef, Egypt, and the Golden Calf. What is this all about? And as I said, this will give us an incredible insight into the Egyptians, which is what Pesach is all about. We have to understand where we were in order to understand what it means to get out of there. It'll give us an incredible insight into Yosef, and ultimately it will be something that we will find very relevant to ourselves. Yosef is, he rises to power. Let me throw in one last thing before I move to this point. Because I left out one aspect which was brought up before. And I just want to throw it in because it just helps fill in the picture. Remember that how did Yosef rise to power? How did that happen? Yosef had been sold by the brothers into slavery. Now, Hashem knows that he's going to use this sale as a way of getting the Jews down to Egypt. Because the Jews have to end up in Egypt. Because that was part of the Bris Ben HaBesarim. That was part of the covenant with Abraham. That Ger Yeh Zarecha Be'eretz Lo Lahem. That your children will be strangers in a land that is not their own. Va'avodum Be'inu Asam Abraham Yoshana. And they will be slaves. They will be worked for 400 years. The 400 years means from the birth of Yitzchak. They were actually there for 210 years, etc. But that was a covenant with Avraham, that these children would be slaves in a land not their own, which of course is going to be Egypt. The Jews have to get there. Now, we've talked about this in other classes, that there's two systems that are operating simultaneously at all times. There's the free will of people, and there's God's plan. God's plan will always happen, no matter what. The plan will take place. Doesn't make a difference what we choose, God's plan will happen. But who will play what role in God's plan, that depends on our free will. We talked about this with Purim, where Mordechai says to Esther, you can choose to go before Ahasuerus, and if you do, you will be the hero of the story. If you don't, God will find another way to save the Jews, but you'll be out. Meaning, God's plan is always going to happen regardless. But free will isn't compromised because you can choose to be part of the plan or not part of the plan. That's always a person's free will. The brothers chose to sell Yosef into slavery, and the brothers were held accountable for it. We are held accountable for it. And Yosef was sold into slavery. God took advantage of that free will choice to use it to fulfill that covenant with Avram that his children will end up in Egypt. So Yosef gets sold into slavery, and he's there for several years. You have a question?
Did it say Egypt specifically?
No, it doesn't say Egypt. It didn't have to be Egypt. That's true. It doesn't seem like it had to be Egypt. It had to be a very powerful country, but that only happens later, as we're about to describe. Egypt was not such a powerful country when Yosef got sold to Egypt. But once he gets sold there, what happens? He's in slavery, and we know that his master's wife, the wife of Potiphar, starts up with him, and it is a result of that, in order to avoid her, he ends up in jail. And now he's in jail. But Hashem gets him out of jail, because Hashem brings the butler and the baker into jail, and Yosef successfully interprets their dreams. They get out of jail. 2 years later, Paro has a dream, and when Paro has that dream 2 years later, he needs an interpreter. And the butler, who is still alive, says to Paro, Eschatoi ani mazkir ayom, today I remember my sins, and there was this kid in jail with us, Yosef, and he interpreted our dreams correctly. And Paro calls for Yosef, and Yosef interprets Paro's dreams. And by doing so, Yosef becomes the viceroy of Egypt, and Yosef propels Egypt into being the most powerful country in the face of the earth. Because, of course, Yosef interprets the dreams as 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. Nobody else knows that the 7 years of plenty will be followed by the 7 years of famine. So everybody else squanders their plenty during those 7 years, except for Egypt, because of Yosef. And therefore, when the 7 years of famine begin, Egypt is perfectly positioned to become the economic power of the world, and by extension, the military power of the world, etc. That's all because of Yosef. What were Paro's dreams? What does Paro dream about? What? He dreams about cows. He dreams about cows. Seven large cows. Seven small cows. And the scrawny cows consume the large cows, etc., etc. Now, of course, there's two dreams. The second dream are sheaves of wheat. But you have to remember, the second dream of Paro was only, as Yosef says to Paro, the only reason why God gave him two dreams was to show him that it's going to happen right away. The 7 years of plenty are starting now. Not next week, not next year, now. That's why there were two dreams. But the first dream is the main dream. And it's about cows. Now, it's not coincidental that the cow dream is the dream that propels the Egyptians into great world power and propels Yosef simultaneously into being the viceroy of that incredible power. The exact same dream, just like we had before, the same parchment. It's the same dream, the same sequence of events that gives rise to the power of Egypt and Paro and the power of Yosef, all in one fell swoop. Hashem is arranging things in this way, but it's the same dream, the dream about cows. Again, the bovine family. So what is this power? What is it all about? What are the two sides of the coin? Yosef, as I said before, 80 years in power. As what?
Viceroy.
Viceroy. Not Roy. Right, not the king, but viceroy. Yosef is second in command. Remember I mentioned last week that Nisan, the first month, that the mazel, the constellation of Nisan, is the sheep, is Tlez, Aries. What is the mazel, what is the constellation of the second month of the year of Iyar? Okay, no, it's the bull. It's the bull, Taurus. It's the shar. That's the second month. You see, where Tzon, where the ovine family represents Bechor, as we had in the beginning of the Torah, Mi Bechoros Tzono, the shar, par, Egel, that whole family represents the second in command. Now we're talking my language because I'm the second born. Unlike last time. So that is what the shore represents. It represents the second in command. Mitzrayim, remember last week we showed that back in the story of the Migdal Babel, the Tower of Babel, we showed where Mitzrayim leapfrogged, where they initiated the whole to-do over there with the tower. Even though Mitzrayim wasn't the firstborn of Cham. We said Cham had four children. And Mitzrayim leapfrogged, and the way the Torah, the way Rashi lists them, you'll recall from 2 weeks ago, that what are the four children of Cham? They are Cush, number one, Cush, number two, Mitzrayim, number three, Put, and number four, Canaan. And Rashi lists them switching one and two. Mitzrayim, Cush, Put, Canaan. But it should have been Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, Canaan. It should have been Mitzrayim second, because Mitzrayim is in its essence, the second in command. But Mitzrayim didn't want to be the second. Mitzrayim wasn't interested in being second best. Mitzrayim wasn't interested in being vice Bechor. Mitzrayim wanted to be the Bechor. And that's where you have the struggle between Mitzrayim and the Jewish people. And that's when Hashem tells Moshe to tell Paro, make it clear to Paro, you are out of your element. You're not the Bechor. The Jews are the Bechor. You do have a place in this world, but not as Bechor. Not as the firstborn. Not as center stage. Your place in this world is second, is Shor, is the month of Iyar, is the second month of the year, not the first. That's where you belong. Just as Yosef is the viceroy. Now let's think about Yosef for a moment. Go back to Yaakov working for 7 years to marry Rachel. That's why he worked for 7 years. And in the end, he's duped by Lavan, and he ends up marrying Leah. A week later, he marries Rachel, and now he works for another 7 years. But Rachel is really the one he wanted to marry, and Leah is, he was duped into marrying. Hashem sees that Leah is not loved the way Rachel is. Of course, you understand, it says Hashem saw. That it's very clear in the Pesukim. It was not clear to anybody else. You couldn't tell from the outside or from the inside. Rachel and Leah didn't know. They didn't know that Yaakov loved Rachel more than Leah, but Hashem saw that Yaakov loved Rachel more than Leah. It's very, very clear in the Pesukim that there was no way to know except for Hashem knowing. It's only after Hashem made Leah be able to become pregnant and not Rachel, that then Leah said, oh, it must be that I'm not loved because Hashem is giving me children and not my sister. That was all because she figured it out from the way Hashem treated them. But for Yaakov's treatment of the women, there was no way to know. At any rate, Leah, therefore, has the firstborn, and that's Reuven. And then she has Shimon. Then she has Levi. Then she has Yehuda. Then Rachel, who sees she's not having children, takes her maidservant Bilhah, and Bilhah has Dan and Naphtali. Leah takes her maidservant Zilpah, she gives her to Yaakov, she has Gad and Asher. So there are already 8 children born. And then Leah has 2 more children, Yisachar and Zebulun. 10 children are born. And finally, after 10 children, Rachel finally conceives and has Yosef. Yosef should have been the firstborn. Yosef should have been the firstborn. That's what he was meant to be. Had things gone smoothly without Lavan intervening, then Yaakov would have married Rachel, and then Yosef would have become the firstborn, the Bechor. In the end, he was robbed of his Bechora because of the whole episode with Rachel and Leah and Lavan. Does that faze Yosef? There is strife within the brothers. There is an issue over there of perhaps there might be favoritism, etc. But in the end, Yosef becomes the viceroy of Egypt. Not the first, not the president, the viceroy, the vice president. Yosef, when he was first growing up in his first 17 years, engendered a certain degree of jealousy between his brothers and he. And for whatever reason, he did not take it into account. And the brothers, there was a jealousy there. The brothers are still held accountable for selling Yosef. But Yosef is also held accountable for bringing on the jealousy. As his father yells at him, if you're going to go telling your brothers about these dreams you're having, that they're all going to be bowing down to you, all you're going to do is make them jealous of you. Don't do it. Don't tell them about it. But he does. That leads to his being sold. We don't know in the first 17 years. Maybe Yosef wasn't prepared to be the second best. I don't know. We can't criticize Yosef any more than we can criticize Moshe. Not without Chazal telling us. But at the same time, when Yosef is sold, and he does rise to power, he rises to power as the second in command. And he's very comfortable as the second in command. He takes that position and makes it all it can be. From the position of second, he defines himself. He becomes himself. He is Yosef HaTzadik, the righteous one, in his role as the second in command, as viceroy. When, yes, any question? No. Late, yeah? Again, what? The Yosef's children? Yeah. That's a good point. We'll bring that in. Very good. When what's being brought up is that later on, when Yosef gives a blessing to his 2 children, Ephraim and Manasseh, he puts Ephraim before Manasseh, Ephraim being the second born, Manasseh being the first. That's a very good addition to this talk. Very, very good. I just forgot where I was going, that's all. Just give me a moment. When Yosef as the viceroy of Egypt, if I keep talking, eventually it'll just hit me. Yes? Yeah, no, I remember what I said, but I don't remember where I was going. And so much pressure with the tape here and everything, you know. What time? Yeah, Mitzrayim wanted to be firstborn. Right. No, but here's what I wanted to say. Yosef reaches such a level of perfecting the position of being second, of being the viceroy, which is represented by Shor. Now, here's the incredible thing. And I already said it before. That's the thing. I mentioned it before, but I mentioned it very quickly so no one would catch it. When Moshe Rabbeinu gives the children of Yosef the bracha, in Vizos HaBracha, at the end of Yom Moshe's life, what does he say? He says, Bechor Shoro. Yosef has become a Shor that is at the same time a Bechor. Yosef has married these two powers. The power of Shor, second, with the power of Bechor, first. How does that happen? Is he a Shor? Is he a Bechor? Isn't that Mitzrayim's mistake? That they're rejecting being Shor? They'd rather be Bechor? They don't want to be second best? They want to be best? Isn't that a mistake? What's this Bechor Shoro? The answer is that Yosef was the Bechor of being a Shor. Yosef was the best at being second best. Interesting. The best, the first, at being second. That's what Yosef was. You see, Yosef didn't say to God, I don't want what I am. I reject who I am. I reject the blessings you've given me. I want what someone else has. Don't give me this. I want that. I want what Yehuda has. He's the king. I want what Aaron has. He's the Kohen. That's what I want. That's not what Yosef says. Yosef doesn't say, I prefer this, that, or the other thing. I prefer that house, that car. That's not what Yosef says. What Yosef says is, I'm very comfortable in my own skin. And I will use it to perfection. And when the Shor perfects himself to the best that a Shor can be, he becomes the Bechor of the Shor. The best of the Shor. The best of the second. Yeah.
Did you think he should have done the first one?
Yeah.
So he's pretty much like giving up the fact that he should have been.
He didn't have it. He didn't have it because of events that preceded him. Yeah, he should have. That would, had things gone differently, it's a good question and perhaps the subject of a future class. And there's a lot to say about this, of how did Lavan do that? Lavan basically altered everything that was going to happen. But that has a lot to do with Esav also. Because really in the grand scheme of things, Rachel was supposed to marry Yaakov and Leah was supposed to marry Esav. So there's a lot going on over there which is way beyond what we're doing tonight. It is something which we can talk about at some point. And I trust it to all of you to remind me that at some point we talk about it. But it is something which we can do. But suffice it to say, Yosef couldn't get it. He wasn't the firstborn, even though he was meant to be. But instead of complaining, and instead of saying, I wish I was, he said, no, I am what I am, and I'm going to make it the best I can be. And through that, Yosef rises to being the greatest of the Shor. He perfects this koyach, this strength of Shor. In stark contrast to the rejection of Egypt, Yosef perfects it. Egypt ends up on the bottom of the Red Sea, of the Yam Suf, and Yosef rises. Yosef actually parts the Yam Suf. His Aron is actually what makes the Yam Suf part. Yosef rises to perfection. Yeah.
I have another question. Did Mitzrayim know, so to speak, what their role should have been?
Okay, that's a good question. How much they knew, how much they didn't know, how much was based on their own succumbing to their own vices, etc. That's hard to know. They knew. It's clear that people knew more about these things in those days than we know today. It's clear that people were much more in tune with these sorts of ideas. They certainly knew the constellations. Mm-hmm. That they understood fully. They knew their roots. They knew
their role in that.
Excuse me?
They knew their role in that.
That's hard to know. I can't say that for sure. But the result certainly was a rejection. Good question. No?
Somewhat off the topic, but when Reuben lost the Bechor, when he's no longer the Bechor, why did that automatically default to Levi rather than perhaps...
That's also a very good question. An excellent question. It's also a separate discussion. I actually spoke about this in Dunwoody. In the beginning of the year, and it's a fair question, something which we can take up at some other time, but it's a fair question. We'll add to this that Yosef's own children, Ephraim and Manasseh, where as was mentioned, that Ephraim and Manasseh, where Yosef puts Ephraim before Yaakov, puts Ephraim before Manasseh, Ephraim who is second, and he gives him the greater blessing than Manasseh. And Yosef says to Yaakov, no, it's not the way it's supposed to be. And Yaakov says, no, I know about that. I know, I realize. And this is the way I mean. I'm doing it on purpose. And he gives Ephraim the bracha before Manasseh. We do not find that there was any acrimony between Manasseh and Ephraim. We don't find Manasseh complaining, yelling, screaming, it was supposed to be me. We don't find that. Because Manasseh is from Yosef. And Yosef is the perfection of this quality of saying, God gave me a certain position, and that's what I'm going to perfect. It is not my place to try to usurp somebody else. And it is not my place to be what I'm not. It is my place to be what I am, to perfect who I am. That is the power of Yosef. And that is the flip side of the failure of Mitzrayim. And so, as we approach Pesach, and we focus on Bechor, which means making us the center of history, of making us center stage, which we are, the Am Segula. We are the chosen nation. We are God's special people. We are His Bechor, which is true. But within our own people, relative to the world, we're Bechor. But we're not all Bechor relative to each other. You can't have several million people all being the king. You can't have several million people all being the head. You can't even have in one community everybody being the head of the community. You can't have that. Only one. There can't be more than that. Otherwise, nothing gets done. You have to have one leader. And within everybody's own small world, there's a totem pole. There's a hierarchy. No matter what you talk about, be it positions of power, be it financially, whatever it is, be it positions in a family, there's always going to be a hierarchy. It is not our job to wish we were something else. It is not our job to usurp somebody else. It is our job to identify what we are and perfect it. And that's what Yosef did. And therefore, this complements the whole understanding of Yetzias Mitzrayim, because we were taken out to be the leaders, to be the people that would lead the world to its perfection, that would lead the world in serving Hashem. That's what we were taken out to do. But within ourselves, there are different people with different strengths, with different positions, with different powers, different things to offer everybody else. And it is our job to identify what that is and to perfect ourselves.
Yeah. Do you not have that already with Aaron and Moshe?
Yes, you see that with Aaron and Moshe as well. You do see that with Aaron and Moshe as well. Aaron, in an incredible... that's true. You see that with Aaron and Moshe as well. That is true. Aaron is not the head of a tribe, but he is the head of the Kohanim, which is a very good point. Very, very good. Right. Right. Very good. You're asking that over there, Mordechai says it would happen anyway. Right. As I mentioned with the Purim talk, I believe I mentioned this, my Rosh Hashiva Rabbi Weinberg, Zechon of Blessed Memory, said that had Esther not done it, the Jews would have been saved, but we wouldn't have had a Purim. It wouldn't have been as good as Purim. There is an optimal way, and there's other ways. God has millions of ways of doing something, but there's the preferred way. And one can change history, but one can't change the result of history. You see, you can change which path it's going to go, but all the paths end up in the same place. Right. The preferred path would have been that Esav would have been deserving to marry Leah. Then this whole thing would never have happened. That's really the starting point. And as I said, it's really a much larger discussion. So that would have been the preferred path. But everything ends up in the same place, with Mashiach coming and with the world reaching its perfection. Yeah?
Who's this Micha? Where did he come from?
Micha is also a whole other talk. There's a whole story in Shoftim about Micha. But it's something which is way beyond. He was an idolater. Yeah? Yeah, because of the Medrash says that that it split. What did the CC that it split? And the Medrash says it saw Arono Shel Yosef, the Ark of Yosef, with his bones in it, and with that it split. That leads to a whole discussion why Yosef, etc. Again. That's part of it also. That all ties in together. Okay. Maybe for the 8th day of Pesach. That's a 7th day of Pesach, the splitting of the sea. That's a... Yeah. What's that?
My question really has two parts to it. You said that the Israel are involved with the sheep. So, even if I mentioned that, how they are respected by the sheep?
Well, That's from 2 weeks ago. I'm sorry. That was the whole talk. That was with the month of Nisan, the sheep being Bechor.
Okay.
With Kayin bringing, with Hevel bringing Bechor Sono. That Sono represent the Bechor. Okay, before everybody, just let me just shut this off. Just want to.